Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I want to walk up.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, not say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
This may finally be the week when a new Republic of Ireland manager is named. May not. But forget about that. Now the hunt is on for a new CEO.
Welcome to the Football Pod.
Hey, fellas.
Hey, Owen. How's it going?
How are you? There's a lot going on today's show. Man City having wrapped up the
yeah, let's be honest.
Title. Let's be honest. Yeah.
Done and dusted.
This Jonathan Hill news, which we'll get to. And that's before we even mention another 50-minute conversation about positionism versus relationism coming your way on today's Football Podcast. Because the previous 50-minute conversation on this topic reached the ears of none other than Jamie Hamilton, who has been leading the way in this area of tactical football analysis. He was mentioned in that last piece. His name may indeed have been taken in vain somewhat.
Wow. So he hits back on today's show.
He hits back on today's show, Murphy. He hits John and Jonathan hard on today's show. That's what's going on here. It's football.
He's meeting John and Jonathan
football tactic
halfway
wars.
In this matter.
It's unbelievable. During the week on the World Service, the Champions League return legs. Ireland manager, maybe, who knows. The hunt for a new CEO begins in earnest. Sign up now at secondcaptains.com for £5 a month.
Who's going to hire this new manager?
Exactly. Who's going to be at the press conference? What's going to go on here? Report on sport, please, Ken.
Yeah, and that's the big news today. Wasn't expecting to be talking about him today, but Jonathan Hill to depart his position as CEO of the FAI. The FAI announced this morning. God, yeah, Jonathan Hill.
It's just great, though. I mean, he can leave. He can just, as he walks away for the last time, he can say, well, I've done, mission accomplished, you know. He's literally George W. Bush on that massive ship, whatever it is, three ship. Months after the start of the invasion of Afghanistan. Well, that's that done and dusted. Let's never speak of it again.
Hill commented, since 2020, the FAI team and the wider football community have embraced what has been a radical transformation process for the association, and I'm proud of what has been achieved. We've developed a new dynamic senior leadership team, a clear strategic vision, a bold plan to address football's wider infrastructure needs, and a stable and growing financial platform for further and sustainable growth. A notable step forward was the 2021 Equal Pay Agreement, which has been a vital catalyst for the rapid rise of the women's senior national team over this period, culminating in a historic first World Cup appearance in Australia in 2023. Our successful bids to host Euro 2028 and the UEFA Europa League final next month are testament to the progress delivered by the FAI staff and their incredible commitment and hard work. I firmly believe the future is bright for Irish football. Paul Cook, FAI President, and Jonathan has worked incredibly hard in creating the solid foundations for growth. I'm sure the board, executive, and staff can now build on those foundations to create real change for the largest participation in sport in the country. I wish Jonathan every success in the future. That's Paul Cook, who Has it always been so impressed with Jonathan Hill?
My confidence has been challenged by the events.
Yeah, that was at the Public Accounts Committee hearing.
The FAI's press release ends with the line, Jonathan will leave the association on April 30th. And an interim CEO will be announced in due course, followed by a structured search for a full-time successor.
Oh, no. Have we got a timeline for that? Have we got
a structured search.
A date for that one?
A structured search.
Anyone in mind? Is there anyone with existing contractual obligations who we can't announce just yet?
Well, is this the existing contractual obligations Cannon was talking about?
Ah,
we have to get on with the process of getting rid of our CEO before we can get on with finding a new manager.
Yeah.
Is that what he meant? Because I can say, it's the 15th of April today. It's definitely no longer early April.
It's not early April.
No.
It's mid-April.
The last possible minute of early April is 1 minute to midnight tonight. That's the first half of April.
Yeah. We're getting into mid to late April territory.
No. Hold on a second. Early April is first to, I'm going to say 11th.
Yeah.
Mid-April is 10th
it
to
depends.
22nd.
It depends. Are you going to do early, mid, late, or just going to go early, late? You know what I mean? It's... But it's, like,
no, you have to go early, mid, late.
We can't
just do early and late.
Once we're on April 16th, we can no longer pretend we're in early April. It sounds as though David Correll is going to be the interim CEO. He's the current chief operating officer, Castlebar native. Previous position at the FA is head of business management. Management consultant with Deloitte. In London, transitioned into the world of sport. Key role at the heart of the London 2012 Games as operations manager for the Olympic Stadium. Director of operations for the British Paralympic Association. I'm just reading out his FAI bio. Jonathan Hill said, one look at David's CV will highlight how much he will bring to this role in terms of strategic management and business transformation. Okay, well, looks like he's going to get the chance to strut his stuff in the top job for... possibly quite a long time, you know, and then there's every chance he will be the search will alight upon him as the new CEO.
So the Jonathan Hill news, the writing did appear to be on the wall after that Public Accounts Committee hearing in February. Limped on.
Wondering why the toy man is being in the news.
That might have been a different hearing. So it's limped on even after. There was that strange episode a couple of weeks ago, actually, where the new Sky announces the men's sponsor after so many years, after such a long search, we finally had a team sponsor, which should have been cause for celebration. Jonathan Hill was there, I think, wasn't he?
He was in the room.
There was a John O'Shea press conference,
John O'Shea, Seamus Coleman, don't forget him.
One of those ones at the time, and you would have expected the CEO to potentially say a few words about this amazing news for Irish football. The fact that he didn't let you believe that, he probably doesn't want to be sitting there in front of the media who are going to be asking him about that Public Accounts Committee hearing and what went on there and the lack of full-throated support from Paul Cook and all of those factors. So it did seem like if the CEO can't even stand over this really supposedly good news for Irish football because of everything else swirling around, it feels like there's a lot of baggage there.
Well, he's just been terrible.
Yeah.
He's just been terrible. Why he got the job, I do not know. I'd love to know what was it Roy Barrett, saw in this guy? He just had no feeling for the job, I think, from day one. I can't see any...
Not moving over was a shocking lack of commitment to the job.
Well,
let's be honest.
It's
just outrageous and ridiculous that the FAI chief executive would not be living in the country.
It was just so stupid not to do it.
Yeah.
Right? Whatever about, there's work to be done in London and I'm doing deals and all that. Yeah, sure, okay. But, Vera Powell said to Richie in that interview at one point, it's more important that we look right than perform right. That was her impression of what the FAI, that was of where their priorities lay. Right? That so Vera Powell said, right? But if you consider that, how did he not realize how bad it would make him look to not apparently be interested enough to move to live in the country where he was working?
Because it actually is important that we look right. I mean, it's important that we are doing things correctly, but also that everyone sees that it's been done correctly after the previous regime and everything that went with that. And
just felt like,
there's been so many missteps along the way.
Yeah, it's not like he...
It's not serious.
It's not like he thought... Oh, it's the right thing, that I should... And so on this basis, I'm going to live in London so I can very speedily... lockdown and new sponsor for the men's national team. It's like he just couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
You know, he just didn't care
just
enough.
Just went on and on and on. Yeah, never did it.
Just didn't care enough to actually to make the decision to move.
There was also then this strange prerequisite, which the FAI have never said publicly, I don't think, but this idea that they want the manager to live / have a base in Ireland when the CEO isn't doing the same thing. Seems odd.
Imagine being Lee Carsley listening to that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Well, Lee, you know, it's really important that you move out of the country where all of our players playing to live in Ireland for the duration.
He still would be. I mean, that's not what he's lost his job for, though. I mean, they're saying he's just finishing up. There's no. Is there any reason given actually for why did he say why?
Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished.
Certainly the pressure that's come on him in recent years. Part of it is underlying everything that he hasn't moved over. But it's also obviously been the holiday. The issues around the holiday pay and the subsequent appearances to try to explain.
Yeah.
Well, that was
just also his general performance in the job has just been really bad.
Well, he didn't get the whole thing was supposed to be some kind of sponsorship, guy who understood like business and commerce and stuff. And he didn't actually get a sponsor for, what, 3.5 years? Like,
that's incredible.
Like he became the CEO in November 2020, and they announced that sponsorship deal in March 2024. Mm. So it's 3.25 years. Like, come on, you know, this was meant to be his strong suit, and you know it didn't happen for ages. There's been like this indecision over things. I mean, you know, the interim manager's situation. You know, just like make a decision. You know, there was obviously no plan with the Stephen Kenny thing. Okay, they let that go to the end rather than say, okay, let's finish up and try and move on this manager situation. Okay, which I think fair enough. You know, but like they had plenty of time to sort of put together a plan. Didn't manage to put together any kind of a plan. You know, Canham is fronting this disaster. You know, his face is there front and center. But it's like the CEO who's the ultimate authority in the organization. It's his job to make a decision on this. Are we going to appoint John O'Shea? Just do it then.
Well, yeah, hang on. That was a bit of a problem with the previous CEO being a bit too decisive.
Say
with the Steve Saunderman, which was very much seen as his appointment.
Yeah, know? I mean, of course, and Jonathan Hill at least didn't make the same mistakes as John Delaney. Or didn't have the same. You know, we used to criticize John Delaney for like, oh, Delaney, here he is running around on the chicken and ham circuit, you know, present of flesh, shoring up his political base. You know, he's got no vision. He's got no, apart from just trying to keep this, keep the show on the road a few more days, a few more weeks, a few more months, whatever. But, you know, at least he's going around shoring up his base. I mean, he's met all these people.
Yeah, we didn't need Jonathan Hill to just be like the bizarro Delaney.
The opposite.
Yeah. If Delaney meets people and lives in Ireland, then I should do the exact opposite.
Yeah. No,
that's
I mean,
not what we were hoping for.
But like, I just really can't think of much good that happened on his watch.
Well, you've got the little rundown there.
Well, there is a rundown, the equal pay, of course. I suppose that is good. I don't want to say that's not good. And of course, the plan for infrastructure, which seems to be basically saying to the government, we're going to need this much. And then having said to the government, having pitched to the government, basically, we're going to need all this money for infrastructure. And it's really worthwhile investing in this sport because actually loads of people love it and loads of people, way more people could participate in it. And it could be a really good thing for the country. You then make a fool of the organization by getting caught in this like small beans, you know, oh, 12 grand, you know, this ridiculous situation over a small amount of money, which became this big, you know, it was like, oh, they're at it again. You know what I mean? Like really the whole point of this new regime is supposed to be, we're no longer, you know, this hopelessly corrupt and inept organization. We're new. It's all new. And then like, it's, oh, what's this 12 grand? You know what I mean?
But it wasn't just the fact that they were asked for explanations. It was the fact that the explanations that they gave, especially the most recent Public Accounts Committee, were just, literally, it was a joke. You know, it was a literal joke, supposedly, at the middle of this thing. And that just came off so badly.
Yeah, this was the one thing. The one thing you had to do was avoid any suggestion of financial, you know, malpractice. That was like one, that was like almost stipulation one. Just try and keep everything above board. Yeah. Then it's like, oh, what's this accidental talk about? Oh, you know, obviously the money's been paid back. And the point is that it became his little thing there became this big story rather than the case that the FAI are trying to put for this major investment. You know what I mean? It's terrible. So I can't really say that this is a sad day for Irish football alone. I mean, I wait with interest to see what the structured search brings us. But
it's certainly chaotic, though.
But I mean, I'm happy to say twist. You know, sticker twist, I'm saying twist. Let's twist on this
one. It's just mad that this is happening at the start of the week where we're told we'll finally get the manager situation sorted.
This week is infrastructure week at the FAI. Basically what we're... Every Monday morning.
Yeah. So, okay. There was a football happening over the weekend, and we're going to get to our, don't worry, positions and racialism. Another bad week for our Nazi listeners. Some in-depth tactics talk in a way. But before then, there was also
Man City winning
some football.
The league.
Yeah. Well, Bayer Leverkusen winning the league. Let's not jump the gun here. Bayer Leverkusen
actually won the league. Yeah.
Manchester City, it just looks like they're going to win the league.
You know, looks like
they're going to win the league. And can I say, first of all, to Granit Xhaka, there were times when I criticized Granit Xhaka and suggested that he wasn't really all that good.
Maybe I didn't love you.
You know, I wondered what Arsenal were doing with this Granit Xhaka guy running around, their midfield, sort of launching himself into crazy tackles, getting sent off, telling his own fans to fuck off and all this kind of thing. Granit Xhaka is a very good football player who has won a league title, richly deserved, with a brilliant team. And he's been... Did you see the goal he scored?
No.
They won 5-0 in their last game.
I saw some of the post-match interviews with our friend Archie Rintoto, right?
Yes.
He's having a good time.
Frimpong was just leaning on him.
Hiding from his teammates, I think you were.
Everyone's running around throwing beer on everybody. You know, everyone's being a good sport about it, mostly. Hull Stadium is full of red smoke. Florian Wirtz scores a hat-trick. Granit Xhaka scored the second goal, which was kind of the moment when they knew, yes, we are definitely going to win the league today. A great goal. Has been brilliant for them all season. And he wins the league on the day that Arsenal, I don't want to say lost the league, but this obviously was not good. This was really bad. And the thing that I couldn't believe, actually, about the Arsenal-Aston Villa game was the empty seats at Arsenal. You know, like, there was people, and I know it's like, well, you know, this track, you don't know what it's like. No, I do know what it's like. It can be unpleasant, but, like, it is... something that happens all the time, you know. It's, you sort of sign up for it if you go to, and there was like 10 minutes left to go, and there was people, you know, when you include the extended injury time you're going to have, and people were sort of deserting the team.
Well, that is notable in that it's something that Arteta's been so big on after practically every big match. He talks about the fans, and he genuinely actually it does seem to have built quite a good atmosphere there, certainly when things are going well. It seems a lot more raucous than we maybe remember it previously.
Oh, it is.
But you do need those fans when you're on your knees and when it's all going wrong.
Well, people just didn't believe that they could come back. I mean, the people were right. They were correct about that. And it's amazing, this kind of sense of total hopelessness that seemed to settle quickly over Arsenal and also earlier over Liverpool, faced with this, we've just gone behind Man City and it's over now, even though there's 6 games to go. And you can see there's a lot of this, obviously, as the narrative wars are being played out, there's a lot of Man City sort of people saying, well, oh yeah, you know, you were saying that we weren't that good this year. Now suddenly it's like, oh, we never had a chance. How can we possibly compete with this, and sort of laughing at that nonsense. I think you were always... You were always pretty sure Man City were going to...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. me too, I think, wasn't it? Hadn't I been?
You were as well, yeah.
It's like...
Well, there was a ludicrous stuff earlier on in the season where certain people here were talking about Aston Villa as title contenders.
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, Aston Villa took 9 points off Man City and Arsenal.
Aston Villa were having a great season at that point, but even the most hardened Aston Villa supporter would probably say we'd bite your hand off for Champions League football.
Yeah.
And that might be what they're going to get now.
If City were 4 points down today, I would still be Man City to win the league.
Really?
Yeah.
You really have a lot of faith in these guys.
Yeah, I do, yeah. And all I have to base that on is just a repeated season after season of results and data.
And there's a lot of talk of the number 115 today. And, you know, and I can see also the sort of riposte that, oh, yeah, 115 charges. That's why, you know, select Havertz, Darwin, Trossard, Salah, whoever. Whoever it was. I mean, I've never seen so many massive chances missed.
Oh, my.
You know, huge. Yeah. And this is why, you know, 100, I suppose it was 115 charges because, you know, there was something that went on at Man City in 2013. That's why they can't score this, like, open goal. But I suppose that, you know, a lot of people would also think, you know, do people look at an iceberg and think, wow, look at that thing floating around on the top of the water there, you know? You know, how does it not flip over? You know, it's just such a huge structure, just floating on the surface of the water. It's amazing, isn't it? I suppose there's the sort of thought that people have, you know, 115 is what we know about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an element of that, on.
Any update on it?
The Everton maybe getting to more points. You know, like, we don't know. It's obviously a complex case. You know, we all wish they'd get on with it. But just on the Arsenal, maybe Kai Havertz is going to follow a Granit Xhaka trajectory over the next 7 or 8 years. By which I don't mean, you know, eventually win the title with Leverkusen, his former team. But, you know, maybe he'll prove me wrong, Owen.
No, he'll prove you right just way later than you had hoped. Because you were with him.
I was with him before I was against him.
Now you're against him.
I was with him before I was against him.
He wants to get you back on side at some point.
No, it was an interesting game because he, you know, Unai Emery against Arsenal. I think I feel like he enjoys this game for obvious reasons. But I think he's also kind of quite well equipped to kind of neutralize the Arteta system. You know, he understands what's going on and he's like, okay, I think. And Arteta said after the game, we should have scored 3 or 4 in the first half. I wasn't sure about that. I mean, I think they definitely should have scored one. That was Trossard. You know, there was a couple of chances, like Saka had one, and, you know, Odegaard had a shot that was blocked. And then there was, like, a bunch of chances for Havertz, but they weren't really great chances. They were chances where Arsenal had identified this thing where they could kind of launch Havertz from who they played in midfield rather than up front, which is where he's been playing for most of the last while they've been winning a lot of games. And they put him back into midfield, where I don't think he's really been that impressive. But the idea was, let's get him running through. And it happened so many times, The problem is, he's just not very good at doing that.
We did have an email last week from Harry saying, hi all, Ken's reference to King Kai's 9 goals in 23 matches, which you were somewhat sneering of, it needs context. When discussing King Kai, we keep hearing here, his goal contributions across 30 appearances in the Premier League, please keep in mind only 8 have come at centre forward, 22 appearances have come from midfield. On only one occasion this season has Kai Havertz failed to score or assist when starting at centre forward. Surely this should be factored into any analysis of his goal.
Well, I think that Mikel Arteta probably, you should send that to Mikel Arteta so he doesn't do this again. Because I felt that Arsenal didn't really have much of their usual cohesion. You know, it was sort of like everyone sets up and then let's give the ball to Odegaard and see if he can sort of chip it in there. And it wasn't like they were making a stream of chances. I mean, Arteta said it was one of our best performances in the first half. I didn't think so. I mean, Watkins came closest to scoring out of anybody, and that was a breakaway. And Watkins eventually scored as sort of a breakaway. Arsenal have conceded a couple of these now in the last week. You know, this is the sort of thing that starts to undermine your confidence. The two goals that Villa scored were both from corners, and they nearly scored from a previous corner when Tielemans hit the bar and post.
Oh, yeah.
Which would have been an absolutely amazing goal. But Arsenal's whole thing this season has been, you know, we're the best team at set pieces, both defensive and attacking. The first goal was a Villa corner, which they worked back in. And the second, Havertz was the player who didn't block the cross. The second was an Arsenal corner, which was a mistake by Jorginho. They played the ball in, the centre-backs were up because it's a corner, it comes back to Jorginho, and he just tried a mad pass.
It was mad. I think it was a guy, whoever was in co-commentary, was screaming for Jorginho to come on. He said, they've got to make changes. They've got to bring Jorginho on, get a bit of control of this midfield,
yeah,
and
no,
then
completely.
He comes on and does that.
But I agree, I totally agree. I think Jorginho is quite important, and I think he helps Rice to look good. I think he does. You know, Rice looks better when Jorginho is playing. Even Rice was getting blamed because, you know, after this, like, it's so disappointing for Arsenal. It's amazing how quick the blame then starts. Like, Zinchenko is a hate figure for a lot of Arsenal fans. Zinchenko actually played quite well in the game. I mean, he made a couple of mistakes. But I saw him, for example, being criticized for, like, why is he the wrong side for this goal? Like, if you look at the first Villa goal, Bailey obviously scores arriving into a completely empty space on the far side, which is like the left back zone. Zinchenko's over the other side. What's he doing over there? He's there for every corner. That's literally his job on all the corners. He's over that side, you know? He obviously didn't manage to see. He was the guy who tried to nutmeg Tielemans when Tielemans then hit that great shot off the woodwork, which was a mistake. But he was also the guy playing Havertz in a lot of the time. I thought he did okay, but it doesn't really matter. You know, you're going to get hammered. But I was surprised even Rice getting criticised. You know, this guy, he's not... You know. Rice has been amazing for Arsenal this season.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like consistently amazing. Just because he's not brilliant at absolutely everything doesn't mean that he hasn't been a huge player for them. And it is astonishing to me how even a team that's having a great season will so quickly turn on...
Have they turned on... Everyone just gets annoyed after they lose a game.
It's turning!
We're not quite at that. I don't think the Arsenal fans are talking like that about Declan Rice just yet.
Yeah. It's like, you know, Gakpo. I think Gakpo was having a similar experience. Liverpool came on the other day and was one of their best players. Again, he did this. He's done this a couple of games in a row. Probably should have started the game. But
So Man City have Brighton, Forest away, Wolves. Come on, like Fulham away.
Well, there's don't forget Spurs. Muniz, you know.
They've all got Spurs. Yeah, Muniz for Fulham, yeah.
Well, Spurs are huge. Spurs are the kingmakers.
Yeah, everyone's got Spurs at some point. And then their last game is West Ham at home. I don't know.
Come on. That'll be 7-0. For fuck's sake.
Yeah.
It is over.
Yeah. I mean, Fulham, I think Liverpool have to go away to play Fulham as well. Is that their next game? You know, Fulham... look pretty good at the moment. You know, they're a little Brazilian. Did you see the video of Muniz getting the Player of the Month award?
No.
Oh, it was actually good. Yeah. Muniz, he was the Premier League Player of the Month, and he was doing some like interview with, like, the Fulham channel. And then Willian and Pereira, Andres Pereira, arrived, and they're like, oh, you know, well done, bro. You deserve it, bro. And he just breaks down. He's like, I don't know what to say. he's weeping like with just happiness at, like, and pride at what he said, and they're like just forming this little Brazilian love situation.
What brilliant player never won the player? Was it Ryan Giggs? Never won the PFA player, the Premier League Player of the Month.
Maybe. I don't know.
Listen, it's a hell of an award.
It's a hell of an award, and he's got the chance to, you know, score some important goals in the title run in.
What about Liverpool?
Well, you know, I mean, just incredible what's happened to them. There was a moment of, I mean, obviously, Crystal Palace welcomed Michael Olise back for the first start since Roy Hodgson tried to assassinate him.
by bringing him on Hodgson
tried
hamstring.
To destroy Michael Olise. And then he got injured and he's been out for like months, but he was back for this. I think he came on as a sub against Man City, but he started this game. He's really good. They've got a lot of like excellent players.
Yeah. Olise misses a lot of football with injury. And Eze missed some as well. But when the two of them are playing, they look dangerous.
Yeah, and Wharton, I think, was very good for them in midfield. But like they, you know, Liverpool's usual kind of groggy start. Palace passing the ball around. Palace scored a great goal. You know, 21 pass move or something like this. And then, you know, I mean, they managed to, in the second half particularly, have chances. And they produced a string of the most unbelievable misses.
Not just Darwin,
no.
Fair.
He led the way. Like, he set the tone with his... He turned and whacked the volley from... It has to be a goal. He hits it straight at the keeper. But then, I forget the order of them. Was Jota next? Everyone has sort of built up Jota into this, like...
He can't miss.
Yeah, he's, you know, Jota is like this goal cyborg who just...
Yeah, like he can't really move, but as long as we can just, like, wheel him into position, you know, lumber him into position somehow, and he will just...
He literally cannot
him.
Miss. Yeah. It's just like, he's just not programmed that way. But, he had his shot saved. The Jones one was the most dramatic because Jones is played in, and like it's the whole place is rising. Oh, you know, it's going to happen to Jones. Oh, Jones. He boots it wide with an incredible dramatic flourish. And then Salah, you know, who had like the last 20 minutes or so of the game from Salah was just one, like it was an absolute clown show. It really was. It was just, what is happening to him? You know, why is he? He's just melting down.
I was wondering what words you were going to go with there. Clown show is harsh, but also like...
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Yeah. You know, it's just, I can't understand it. So they had, you know, when you miss so many chances, obviously you deserve to lose. And it's just incredible how it's just, you know, after months and months and months of, oh, it's so exciting.
Murph is right. You need City to be a lot further behind.
Yeah,
I mean, it has been exciting, to be fair, because everyone's been given a chance to think that maybe Arsenal.
Yeah.
It's because it's two. It's not if it was just Arsenal all the way, you'd be thinking, they'll probably fall off. But the fact that Liverpool have been there, you know, yeah, surely would.
Listen, well, by the FAI calendar, it's lasted all the way to early April. You know, yeah. And you know that's not nothing.
Yeah, I think it's
not nothing.
Yeah, we'll wait and see. I do feel that the City games all look like games City should win. You know, I'm not kind of feeling. The Tottenham game is the one, is the interesting one. But of course, then you see Tottenham fans saying, oh, you know, obviously that's not a game they want to win because it would be, you know, God. It's sad. It would be sad to win it for Arsenal in this sense. I mean, Tottenham are under a bit of pressure now, Champions League-wise, because of the Villa results and because of their own result at Newcastle, where Mickey van de Ven played the worst 90 seconds of any defender. Just in terms of the sheer spectacular nature of what happened to him, I think there was a video of Livramento talking to Isak as they came off the field. And Livramento kind of had gone up to Isak, who scored the first goal. Van de Ven fell over spectacularly, like he ended up doing almost a somersault, and Livramento says to him, did you see what happened to their centre half? Isak hadn't seen because he was like looking at the goal. It was happening to his side. You know, he goes, oh, he just kind of, you know, like someone had lip read it and it did look to me as though that was what he was saying. I mean, it was unbelievable. A few seconds later, he does exactly the same, or not exactly the same thing, but it falls over again to allow Anthony Gordon to score. Anthony Gordon, by the way, we were saying he's quite good, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, yeah.
He's so reluctant. I think it was a way for that podcast when you were almost reluctantly accepting that Anthony Gordon is good. He's quite obviously a very good player.
Well, yeah, no, it's more that we've taken again a moan. I mean, you know, it's just one of our trademarks.
It's a bit, he's a shithouser, so it's not about that, but
yeah.
It's good football.
Well, sometimes it can be hard to tell if someone really is good. You know, just thinking score a few goals and, man, it looks good and instantly doesn't.
I think he's a proper player. Great.
What else? What about Sammy Smolik, so? Is he a proper player?
Well, based on the glimpses that I've seen him in a green jersey, I would say yes.
What about
two appearances?
Imrord and Cadesco. Again, is what I would say, Sammy Smolik.
What was that?
Imrord and Cadesco.
Top class.
Player of the first class.
Oh, Imrord.
Yeah.
I got there quicker than Ken on that one. Than Cadesco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why I just winked at you there, but
now he became the first visiting player to score a winning goal at Elland Road this season. And I hope that didn't escape your attention. 30 goals for him this season.
That's bloody good.
Bloody good.
It's pretty good. I wonder where he's going to end up. Maybe Arsenal should sign him. Maybe Arsenal need a bit of the Smodix factor.
Why are we always trying to move players on?
Well, because he's
like,
playing.
Like, Evan Ferguson scores a few goals. Where's he going to go?
He scored 30 goals this season playing for Blackburn, who are, you know, fighting relegation from the Championship. I think, you know,
it's a pretty high level of production.
I'm happy enough if he wants to keep operating around the lower reaches of the Championship, scoring 30 goals every season and being really confident coming into Ireland camp. That'll do me just fine.
I don't need a Premier League. They've scored
57 goals in 43 games, Blackburn Rovers, in the Championship.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if all those goals are in the league.
No, they're not, but it's still... He didn't get a hat-trick in the FA Cup.
He scored about 25 in the league, yeah, I think. So, Yeah, it's pretty good. I think, you know, he could probably play it at a slightly higher level than that.
James McLean got promoted as well at the weekend, lest we forget.
I keep
James
McLean,
Ryan
team.
Reynolds and Rob McElhenney all got promoted.
What's the Kirk called again?
Yeah, sorry?
What's that? What is
from League Two up to the League One.
Yeah, that's great. That's brilliant.
Wrexham's club captain. Well, he's... I don't know if he's club captain, but he's certainly been captain in a lot of games recently.
And will there be a video made of this?
Yeah.
We need to see inside the Wrexham story, Murph. I want to hear more about it.
If that's what you want, lads, buckle up, because season three is imminent.
We're going to talk Ireland now. Delighted to say, Ken Early from the Second Captains podcast joined us.
Just have a bit of balance, Ken.
Martin O'Neill's record.
Hang on a minute. Did he get to the Euros?
Martin O'Neill's record in the last year.
He got to the Euros. Do you think you're going to get to the Euros with Stephen Kenny, Ken?
Well, I mean, he'd have to be in charge for the next Euros. I mean, we did have a playoff to get to the Euros thanks to finishing
bottom of the Nations League under Martin O'Neill.
You know, literally, we finished bottom of the group.
Me and Michael, we're just sitting back and really enjoying it.
I can't listen
to this rubbish talked about.
Ken, thank you very much for coming on and standing up to Grumpy Chops in the corner. It's been much appreciated. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure to talk to everyone, especially Chris.
Jamie Hamilton, it's good to talk to you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, you were name-checked in our discussion a couple of weeks ago with John McKenzie and Jonathan Wilson. We had been talking at great length about the extremely boring Man City Arsenal game and just what went wrong there. And your name came up because we started to move on to this discussion of, you know, positionism, relationism. This is something that you've been this is a debate you've been one of the leading contributors to over the last few years. I just wondered what you made of that. What did you think when you heard your name being spoken in vain?
Yeah, it was interesting. Someone sent me a link to the podcast and said, "Oh, yeah, you want to check this out?" So, I listened to it and, it got to the point. John McKenzie is someone I've had interactions with before, and he's obviously the tactics expert for TIFO and The Athletic, and then Jonathan Wilson, author of Inverting the Pyramid, yourself. So, yeah, pretty high-profile names doing the analysis. And then, as you say, my name came up, and I think you brought up these concepts of positionism and relationism. It was nice, right? It was nice to hear these concepts that I've been developing in collaboration with others being talked about on your platform by people so knowledgeable. And I listened with interest, and I think there was there are some aspects of the concepts that perhaps I would present differently. And I would have a little bit to say about some of the criticisms that were made, and hopefully that perspective that I'm bringing might be of use to an interest to some of the listeners who might be encountering these concepts for the first time, right?
So, what in particular would have, you must have been listening and thought, "No, this is wrong. This is wrong. That's wrong."
Yeah, the primary critique seemed to be that the guys weren't happy with this kind of reductive dualism, right? This kind of binary framing of these concepts of positionism and relationism. That seemed to be the main issue, and I think both Johns seemed to agree with that. And this is something that's been a criticism that I've had for a while now, and I have I have an issue with it because perhaps the easiest way to approach this is to think about positionism and relationism in terms of zonal attacking and non-zonal attacking. Positionism being a zonal attack and relationism being a non-zonal attack. And as soon as you start putting it in those words, you can see the analog in the defensive phase of football, right? Which would be zonal defending and man-to-man defending, right? And these concepts in the defensive phase, I think, are widely used and have been for decades. I don't know exactly how long, but I think coaches, analysts, pundits are more than happy to use these terms of zonal defending and man-to-man defending when talking about different defensive strategies. So I don't see really why there's an issue with using the same logic to describe distinctions in the attacking phase of football. And I think one of the problems that seems to be is that there's a criticism of the way that positionism is pitted against relationism, right? In a kind of antagonistic way. That can be the case sometimes, but I think contrast is a useful way to look at distinctions between different strategies, just like in the defensive phase. It wouldn't be controversial, let's say, to see some kind of analysis that was, well, let's look at the pros and cons of zonal defending versus man-to-man defending. And then one of the criticisms that kind of comes from that is that, attacking football, possession football doesn't just fit neatly into one of your little boxes, one of your positionist categories or relationist category. And that's fine. And, from the very outset, I've been absolutely explicit in the articles, and I'm not arrogant enough to assume that everyone reads everything I write, but it's clearly laid out.
After that Arsenal City game, you tweeted, Pep and Arteta completed positionism. So what you were saying there was, here we have an example of a game that's these people have cancelled each other out. This is boring. This is stale. This is a dead end. It's like these are the kind of the top rated coaches in the game with some of the most powerful teams, and this is what they've produced. And this is
For sure. But I don't think I was alone in feeling that game between Manchester City and Arsenal spoke to something larger that has been going on in football. I spoke to some kind of discontent among many fans and also coaches regarding the direction of some of the tactical trajectories that are happening in possession football. And, that tweet is, maybe it's you, haven't you said, a little bit barbed? And yeah, maybe it was a little bit of a joke. But I think, it's useful as an entry point, I think, to go into this larger discussion about what is actually going on here. Like, why did we get a game like that? What is positional play? What is positionism? It's a small tweet, and, that's
well,
fine.
Well, let me put to you then something, someone else, Marco Sullivan, who I'm sure is a PhD, a associate professor of football researcher, UEFA coach, and he's listened to our pod, I know, for a few years. But he got in touch to say, well, he was complaining that he didn't think the relationism was presented well on the thing. But he said John McKenzie thinks relationism is a thing. One by John obviously isn't here, but this is just what was commented. He thinks relationism is a thing. One way, it essentially prioritizes functionality over structure. How it's implemented is culturally defined. So many examples of this around. The Fluminense versus Man City example, I think I raised that example in the discussion. This is when City beat Fluminense 4-0 in the World Club final. The Fluminense versus Man City example was just stupid. I work deep in this area, Ken. It's helping coaches reevaluate their coaching. It's challenging the homogenization of coach education. Even one of the main people behind the ideas of positionism has big regrets. Now, I think he's referring there to Juan Malillo, the Man City assistant who did a piece with The Athletic during the Qatar World Cup where he said, oh no, everything...
it's all the same now. It doesn't matter where you go. It's all two touch. And I've, you know, if only I hadn't done this, you know, which I always thought was a bit self-aggrandizing of him. You know, he's kind of like, oh, there I go again, completely transforming world football for the worse. You know, will I never learn? But, you know, he was talking about, that's the little thing. Just so to take what Mark was saying in this. Why is the Fluminense, I know you're not Mark, but why do you think he says the Fluminense versus Man City example, which was an example of, you know, the arch positionist team thrashing the sort of arch relationist current team, why is that stupid to refer to?
Well, I think you mentioned it on the discussion, Ken. You know, there's you can't control for some of the variables there, right? And Manchester City are an incredibly powerful football machine, right? And it's like they have huge resources, almost unlimited resources in some sense. Obviously, there's some constraints on them. But the difference between those resources and the resources of Fluminense are huge, right? So regardless of playing style, you've got incredibly high quality, like the best players in the world of Manchester City playing against a group of players that are clearly not the best players in the world. So, you know, you can lose 4-0 to Manchester City, whoever you are, it can happen. But just because of that result, it doesn't mean that the playing style of Fluminense is completely negated, right? It's completely, all right, well, that doesn't work. No, you have to have a more even fight to make a larger sample size to make those kinds of judgments. So for me, it seems, I would agree with Mark. I mean, it seems ridiculous to say that just because Manchester City beat Fluminense, that shows that relationism is, you know, I don't know, what, rubbish, doesn't work.
I accept that. But what about he refers to, I think it's Juan Malo, one of the main people behind the ideas of positioning him, has big regrets. Because Lero did write this piece. It was very interesting. And essentially, you know, everything, it's homogenized and globalized and this cookie cutter tactics, it's stale. Why do you think that happened? Why has this type of football, the Pep type of football, is it just because Guardiola has been successful? Guardiola himself is a kind of a charismatic guru and people are just sort of following that? Or is it something to do with the effectiveness of the ideas themselves?
Well, it's a combination of things, isn't it? It's kind of a perfect storm, really, of what's happened over the last 15 years, but also longer. And, you know, we don't want to turn this into like a long, we don't want to go too far back, but this idea of positional play, and this is what I was talking about at the start, when we think about this as a zonal attack. If you want to, and this, the idea of a zonal attack has been around in football since the dawn of the game, right? The idea that to organize your team effectively, the best way to do that is to assign zonal occupations to your players, right? So you can achieve a collective coherence, right? To get people working together, singing from the same hymn sheet. How do we organize this group of people? Let's use spatial occupations, right? That's the general idea, the base idea. And like, once you start to do that, okay, you can develop in lots of different ways, and it's extremely effective. One of the implications of this using the structure as the basis, like in zonal defending, using the structure as the basis of your strategy, is that when you're in possession and you're using the structure to maximize the effectiveness of the structure, you want to transfer the ball around from node to node throughout the network. And you do that via passing. So you take the ball and pass the ball, as the Guardiola Barcelona documentary is called. Leo refers to it as two-touchism. And the players tend to move less and the ball moves between the players. Guardiola has said this like explicitly numerous occasions in interviews. There's one well-known example after a Man City Man United game where he's asked in the post-match, wow, you know, the interview is like, wow, Pep, incredible movement of your players, like fantastic stuff. And he corrects the interview and he says, no. He says, it looks like the players move. The ball moves. The players stay in their positions and they wait for the ball. So this is the implications of imposing a strict zonal attack, is that you want the structure to do the work, or the majority of the work. I don't want to speak in these absolutes here, but the majority of the work. So you want to pass the ball around this structure because your players are occupying these spaces in the field, which leads to taking the ball, passing the ball, two touches. And of course, if you then start it's effective. So when you get a hugely effective example of it, it trickles down into academy football and lots of coaches think, wow, that's the correct way to do it. But already you can quickly see the implications of that for youth development. if your players are just receiving the ball, passing the ball, receiving the ball, passing the ball, there's a lot of things they're not doing, right? Mm. So their primary reference is, go to my correct zone, wherever that is in the situation of the game, and then I can be a useful node to transfer the ball around this network of the structural network. And that's how it happens. So of course, if you're conditioned to do that, then you're not being conditioned to do all the other stuff, which is maybe some of the stuff that I prefer to see in what I would call relationist football, in more improvised, close quarter combinations, 1-2s, quick tricks, flicks, scoops, moves, diagonals, dummies, different types of combinations. Where in relationism, the players are looking for these combinations, and where they are on the pitch is a result of them trying to find them, rather than in positionism, they go to the space first and then use that structure to facilitate the combination. So it's kind of an inversion there. But yeah, that's why when Leo talks about two-touchism and Marcus Sullivan talks about this homogenization, we've got this paradigm of Guardiolism that has happened over the last 15 years, where coaches have just felt that this is the correct way to play possession football. This is the only way to do it. I have to impose a zonal attack, which I call positionism. And that, obviously, there are many variations of zonal attacks. You can do it in many different ways, more rigid, less rigid, bigger spaces, smaller spaces. But yeah, this is what's happened. And it leads to homogenization, and it leads to players being of a similar type. And I would say it becomes predictable, and it can become boring, and we can end up with more and more matches where we get the similar systems and similar types of players playing against each other.
That Leo piece that we've been mentioning came out during the World Cup. Did Argentina winning that World Cup kind of disprove his thesis a little bit?
In what sense? I mean,
sense he's saying, oh, everything is the same now, and they weren't.
Right. Okay. Yeah. When people are talking about this homogenization, maybe you can make level the criticism that there is always this other version of football, this non-zonal football. And I would agree with that, right? There is like many examples of non-zonal attacks, of relationist attacks being extremely effective, right? Real Madrid winning European Cups, Argentina winning the World Cup, all throughout history, right? We've had incredible Brazilian teams, we've had Hungarian teams, like we've got Fluminense now winning the Copa Libertadores, we've got examples all over the place. So it seems strange to me then, yeah, that this alternative tactical paradigm, let's say, just isn't talked about. And it's not really present in coaching discourse. It's not really present in tactical analysis. What tends to happen is that when analysts see a team that is not organized in a clearly identifiable structural way, they will say, oh, they lack tactics, or the coach has got tactically naive or something like that. And this is because they can't actually see the tactics that are being used, because they're of a different nature. They're of a relationist, non-zonal nature. And it's fundamentally different. So that's, again, one of the uses, I think, of drawing the distinction between the two, is that, not to say that never shall they meet.
Yeah, it's not like Man City players never do 1-2s. Like.
No, exactly. Right. They're present, you know, in different degrees all the time. But I'll keep coming back to it, to the defensive example. It's quite clear that there is a distinction between zonal marking and man-to-man marking. But, I mean, John McKenzie himself has done a lot of work on hybrid pressing, right? The mixture of zonal and man-to-man marking. But of course, to mix something, to have a hybrid of something, you need more than one ingredient, right? You need difference. So I think it's important to draw distinctions and make differences. And you can pit them oppositionally in some sense, if that can be useful. But that doesn't mean that you can't, of course, mix them. And they are always being mixed to some degree, except maybe in the most strict examples. And I think that's why Fernando Diniz was such an interesting example of an extreme non-zonal relationist attack. And Guardiola is such an extreme zonal attack, right? And, you know, that's why it was so interesting. And I think that's why people became interested in it, because you got these extremes going against each other. But more generally, yeah, you're always going to mix. But as a coach, it's really important to understand, what logic am I using when I'm coaching players, when I'm asking them to use reference points in the game? Because for me, that's what tactics is. It's players are always acting in reference to... Oh, Jonathan Wilson mentioned this, right? Saki's four references: the ball, the teammate, the opponent, the space.
Yes, yeah.
And that's fine, but we're 40 years on now from Saki, and just to say that is kind of somewhat banal at this point. We have to actually say, well, which of those references are being prioritized, and what meaning do those references have? Because the, you know, the, you can, as a coach, you can charge those references with meaning. So if I see a teammate and I'm Grealish in Guardiola's system, it might mean, okay, I need to stay a certain distance away from that teammate. I don't want to encroach into their zone. Mm. But if I'm in a Denise Fluminense team, it's like, oh, there's my teammate. I'm going to go close to the close to him and see what kind of trick we can conjure up, right? So the same reference is actually completely different meaning. And this is what coaching is all about. This is, for me, what tactics is. It's the meaning of the references and the prioritization of the player's perception in terms of recognizing what the references are and what they mean. This is for me is what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, the Grealish, you mentioned Grealish, and it's such a pity to see him in that team. You know, it doesn't suit him. And I know that he's kind of quite a high quality cog in this machine, and he kind of can do what Pep wants him to do. It's just that what Pep wants him to do is a bit limited compared to what he can do. And, you know, Pep has in his career said some of the maddest things. Like, actually, this wasn't specifically him, but I always remember Thierry Henry quite early in his, you know, career as a pundit talking about the experience of playing on the wing for Barcelona and Guardiola. And did he kind of came inside and maybe scored a goal or set up a goal. And Guardiola's like, I'm taking you off. You know, I'll take you off if you come inside. He's saying this to Thierry Henry. Right, Thierry Henry, one of the best players of that decade, and Pep is saying, stay on the line or you're off the pitch. He also has said things like, you know, you need 15 passes. This is in one of the Marty Perrineau books. You need 15 passes to establish a proper position before you start to attack and move forward, which is just mad. You do not need 15 passes. This is crazy. But this is like... this is sort of the Pep idea, and you know it's not as though we haven't seen teams operating according to these principles play some of the best football that we've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean the Henry example is kind of a classic one, isn't it? I think it was a Champions League game. He was playing left wing, and he went. He said himself, he said, "I'm bored out here. I want to go play with Messi." Of course, you want to go play with Lionel Messi, who's on the right. He said, and Henry said, "Yeah, I wanted to go make 1-2s with Messi," and he did it. Pep got annoyed. Henry scored and he was hooked off at halftime for breaking the structure, because that's positionism. The structure is the most important thing, and it's above the players. It's like you cannot sacrifice the structure. And of course, well, Guardiola has had problems with many players, right?
Zlatan
is the classic example of this. Like, Zlatan has no time for this guy, right? Mm. He's like, no, he mocks the man, right? He says, no, this I don't want to be a good little boy and do what I'm told. I'm going to express myself. And you know, Yaya Toure was probably perhaps another one. There's various players that really, really don't fit with Pep's version of football, which is fine, right? Everyone can use football, interpret football in the way they want. And it's important to say as well that Guardiola's interpretation is some kind of like, it's kind of this coming up like masterpiece, right? It's weird. It's this genius piece of work that he's put together, this like elegant construction, right? That works so seamlessly well. But that's his interpretation. And the problem that has happened is because of this huge success of Guardiola over the last, 15 years, and like kicking off with that seismic eruption of like the Barcelona team, which was just like insane what was going on. How much of that was Pep and how much is the players is still something you can debate about. But what happened is it almost created this singularity where everyone was like, well, wow, that's football cracked then. That's possession football solved. All we have to do now is follow Guardiola's blueprint, this framework, and copy it. And we're going to play football like that too. But of course, that doesn't account for all the players that are just not suited to this style of football, and all the coaches that are not suited to coaching that style of football, all the fans that don't like watching that kind of football. You can make the argument that it is the most effective, that Guardiola has optimized football. I just don't buy that. And I don't buy that positionism is the only game in town. And like we've said already, there's plenty of examples throughout history and currently. And we can get on even to what these even latest current iterations of relationism. And there's plenty of examples that show non-zonal attacks are completely legitimate, absolutely competitive. And for me, I don't shy away from it. I'm not, you know, I don't hide from the fact that I much prefer to watch and coach this style of football. I have coached in a positional way as well. I was a big Guardiola fan, coached in that hard, strict positionist way. And now that I coach in a different way, I feel a lot better, actually.
So what made you, What made you turn against the Pep, the Pope? What made you, you know, do the Martin Luther on it? You know, what happened? What happened there?
Well, I think, like many coaches, you become seduced by this, by what you're seeing, this style of play. It's so so convincing, right? And it works when you implement it. It really does work on the pitch. But a lot of, well, we mentioned Marco Sullivan as well, and a lot of the work that goes on in coach education kind of actually runs contrary to some of the assumptions of positional play. Because, as I've said, when you're implementing and imposing the zonal attacking structure of positionism, you're limiting the players in a very particular way. All coaching limits players, all coaching constrains players, but you're doing it in a particular way when you do a zonal attack. And some of the research or the people like Marco Sullivan are doing into how players learn, how skill is transferred from training to matches, would suggest that some of the positional constraints are actually not optimal in terms of developing players who can solve problems most effectively in the game.
So give me an example. I mean, we've mentioned sort of the two-touch thing, you know, if you're saying you have to play with two-touch. I mean, that's not really what happens in the game, but what give me some concrete examples.
Deception would be one issue that I would bring up here. If you want to deceive an opponent, and a large part of any kind of game theory is based on deception, right? You want to try and trick the opponent to think you're doing something that you're actually not, and then do the other thing, and you can go through. To deceive an opponent, if you're, let's say you're a player with the ball at your feet, you want to hold, the term that someone like Marco Sullivan would use is affordances, just opportunities for action, possibilities, right? So you want to hold as wide a field of affordances or possibilities for as long as possible, right? So then the player who maybe is coming to challenge you doesn't know which of these options you're going to use, and you're comfortable holding this kind of like uncertainty of all these different array or repertoire of options that you've got. And then the longer you can hold them, the longer you can wait for the defender to show, and then you can select an appropriate one and you can trick him and go the other way or whatever. If then in a more positionist setup, you've already been told, okay, well, get to your zonal occupation, your zonal space, receive the ball, and then look for the next pass, look for the free man. It's already been truncated. Your landscape of affordances has already been quite radically truncated, right? It's been narrowed in a very particular way. So in terms of a player's development, they're not getting that experience of holding that uncertainty for longer and holding that varied field of affordances for longer and becoming attuned to selecting that the appropriate option as the situation emerges in real time, right? It's more of a pre-planned follow a blueprint.
But isn't the virtue of a plan or like a kind of a method that, you know, this is something that everybody knows. It makes they don't necessarily have to communicate in order to be able to cooperate. You know what I mean? Like, rather than sort of making it up and the spur of the moment, which is great if you can do it, but also what if people are, you know, get their wires crossed? You know, this way people, it reduces the crossing of wires.
It certainly does. And it's massively effective, right? I'm not here to dispute the effectiveness of positional play. What it is interesting to think about the possibility that an alternative way might actually be optimal, right? If you can develop enough players to do it in a different way. And not to be all acting on their own, right? There's ways of doing this collectively, of collectively holding varied affordances and understanding similar we've already mentioned references and what they mean on the pitch. And in relationism doesn't mean that just everyone does what they want. No, it's you're creating a different kind of language, a different kind of communication that's not based on, first of all, zones,
yeah,
right. It's based on, okay, we have a different way, a different language.
It's based on first of all what? If it's not first of all zones, then first of all what?
Good question. Exactly the question that I'm probably most interested in right now. If you remove the organizational tool of zonal occupation, what do you replace it with? Because I would agree that if you just remove it, then it's chaos, right? And it's going to be pretty much a shit show. So yes, how do you organize? So the proposals of relationism that I've been working on is that rather than this overriding idea of structure, this kind of imposed down, overlaid meshwork, network, framework style of structure, what you're doing is actually attuning the players to the possibilities of emergent structures. So what's an emergent structure? It could be something as simple as a 1-2. It could be something a little bit more complex, like a third man. It could be a diagonal play, an escadinha, which is a Portuguese term for like a line of players in a diagonal.
And the guy in the middle dummies the ball.
That's right. Right. So if you can imagine when you're playing and you are the players are attuned to recognize when an escadinha forms, let's say four players move into a diagonal. If you all recognize that at the same time, you can use it as a structure. But it's not been imposed down onto you from the start. It can happen anywhere.
Yeah.
It can appear. But the important thing is that the players are collectively attuned to recognize the opportunities, or they recognize the emergences of these structures when they happen, so that they can do the actions in the moment, right, and go through. So that's the kind of coordinations, the kind of organizational references that are being used in relationism. And they're being used right now in various teams, are actually, I must say, experimenting, but certainly taking or adopting some of these principles. And it's interesting to see what happens, because I would say there's a relative amount of success so far with these with this alternative mode of team coherence and team organization, which is what this is all about, team coherence in a different way, because you can organize groups in different ways, right? Like a Roman phalanx is organized differently from Genghis Khan's army war machine of the steppe, right? It's human groups trying to achieve some goal, but you can organize them in very different ways. And I think that it's very clear that over recent times, and perhaps all the way through football tactical history in the West, which perhaps is another aspect we can get into, there has been an overemphasis, in my view, on the top-down emphasis on structural imposition and zonal occupations as the primary means of team organization. I believe that there is much to be gained from embracing alternative forms of group coherence and group organization. Let's see.
Well, when you say the West, you're differentiating between Europe and South America, which is further west in some ways, but not part of the West. Is that okay?
Well, yeah. And not even just Europe. I mean, there's the splits in Europe as well. Maybe say like Western Europe or something like that. But it's definitely one of those interesting things I've found since researching into all this stuff is the strong feelings of people, certainly in South America, people I speak to a lot, Argentina, Brazil, predominantly, about how their style of football, which is, as far as I understand it, has been predominantly organized in a non-zonal way, has been dampened, right, and has been lost in favor of this new wave of coaches and analysts and whoever who believe that zonal occupation is the way. And, you know, someone like Pablo Aimar, who was the assistant coach to Scaloni at Argentina, very vocal about this kind of thing. And also in Europe, you know, Hungary were famously...
Well, we'll get to them in a minute. I'm thinking about it from the point of view of Ireland, obviously. Ireland, we obviously had a manager, Stephen Kenny, who was like, right, we're going to sort of start playing, I guess, a positional game. It didn't go well. We basically won no matches for about 3 years, and he's not on the manager. And I wonder, would you kind of say that, like, when countries like Ireland are trying to cotton on to this, is that like the equivalent of my shoe shine boy is giving me tips about the stock market, it's time to sell? Like, is that an indication that, like, all right, this thing has saturated the world, it's time to start looking at other ways of doing it? I mean, what should a country like Ireland do? This is maybe I don't know how much you've been looking at the specifically Irish football culture, but I guess you're from Scotland. It's not a million miles away. You know, Scotland used to produce all the managers. Don't know what happened to them all. Don't know where are all the Scottish managers at now. But you know, what should countries like Ireland and Scotland be doing? Rather than, you know, before we appointed Stephen Kenny, we had we brought in this guy Ruud Dokter, who's like a Dutch guy, and the idea obviously was, oh, you know, the Dutch guy will come in and suddenly we'll be able to play football like Holland, and, you know, that kind of didn't really work either.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting question, right, about what aspects of culture can actually manifest in your teams or a nation's or a club's, like, localized tactical identity. I think David Winner's book, Brilliant Orange, is very interesting in this, right? Because I think it's a fantastic book. And the way he integrates the intersections of like Dutch history, anthropology, culture, art, and shows how they have in fact influenced this, what became like Dutch total football. I think is a very, very interesting way of doing things. I, of course, am not, I have no idea really about we in terms of Ireland. I wouldn't want to comment, but perhaps it would be interesting and useful to start with some of these cultural aspects. And of course, Ireland has a very rich cultural, historical, anthropological, artistic heritage. And is it possible in the way that Winner has shown happened in Holland and other writers have shown have happened in places like Brazil, is it possible to use some of these broader environmental, ecological aspects as ways of looking at what a tactical identity on the field? I mean, and also you've got other sports, right? You've got Ireland's interesting because it has such popularity in, across a number of sports. And maybe there's some cross pollination that can happen. I'm right, sure. I guess it does happen already. I suppose
you could say that, you know, the type of football that we've generally been associated with, and in fact, we're playing during the most successful phase of the team at international level, which was the kind of 30 years ago. You know, Jack Charlton was a pretty physical style involving a lot of Gary Owens. We play rugby and Gaelic football here, and you know, people like me have been saying, "Oh, we need to get away from that." People are here just watch too much Gaelic football. They think this is what football is. Maybe I'm the idiot, and actually, what we should be doing is this. You know, if people want to sneer at kick and rush, fine. Let's see if they can keep up. We're big boned people from a windy island. We like to kick and rush, and maybe we should
step. Kick and rush. There are ways of playing football, right?
Kick and rush is just the windy form of pass and move.
Right. Okay. Come on. Now we're talking. Right. It's like, look, we don't all have to play on flat passes in triangles, right? It's like, who said we have to do that?
Johan Cruyff and Pep Guardiola.
If they want to do that, that's great. Like, enjoy. No problem. But there are other ways to do things. If you want to play more aerial... For example, I think one of the most underutilized things in football are aerial combinations, right? Playing the ball in the air, right? And it's like, this would be fantastic to watch, and I think it would be really effective. And I think you could start seeing it, you know, relatively soon. If, you know, to get through a compact block, maybe you do flicks in the air. And like, that's not just... hooking the ball down the field in the hope that the big man gets it, right? I'm not really a fan of that kind of thing, right? What I like is teams that are coordinated together in a way, right? But if you have a big guy, yeah, hit it to him, no problem. And you can get a second ball and you can play football. Like, it's no problem. You can play football in any way you want, right? But the, yeah, and so in terms of Ireland, maybe it is a more direct game. Maybe it is for Scotland as well. Maybe it's a more aerial game. Perhaps. I don't know. Scotland, of course, apparently invented passing football, if you believe that historical account, right? Yeah. Queen's Park, like a couple of miles from where I am now, apparently was the first ever passing team. So maybe Scotland should go back and try and embrace that style of football. You can use different starting points and different assumptions, and I don't think there's a correct way, especially when you're talking about something like cultural identity, right? I think it's pretty dangerous to start saying there's some kind of like one essential essence.
Oh, I know. Yeah, this is obviously a major area of discussion these days across a lot of fields, cultural identity, and people complaining, you know, as we've been doing here about the homogenization of, you know, globalism and all, you know, the globalist clowns and all that kind of stuff. But it is interesting though. I read a piece that you did. It was a kind of a collaborative piece. There's a couple of other people involved on Spielverlagerung, a German sort of tactics website. One of the guys involved in the piece was István Bergi, who works with the Hungarian national team as an analyst. Obviously, the Hungarian national team is going great at the moment. Dominic Szoboszlai can't put a foot wrong playing for these guys, which he kind of looks like a bit of a fish out of water playing for Liverpool at the moment. But there was one bit that I thought was interesting, and this is talking about the... there was more than one bit, but this particular bit is talking about the way in which cultural differences, or specifically the differences of language, will change your perception of... well, all kinds of things, but specifically in football. And the example that István, the Hungarian, gives is talking about a 1-2. So in English, we say 1-2. In Portugal, it's called tabela, as in table, representing virtual table the players create while making exchange of passes. This was the interesting one, though. In Hungarian, we say kenizurito, where in which kenizurit as a verb means to force or oblige or constrain, referring to the action as something which the defender is being forced to decide if he follows the runner or the ball. So that's interesting because it means that if you're thinking about a 1-2, if you're Hungarian and you use this Hungarian word, you're thinking about it in terms of its effect on the defender rather than what it is in terms of, well, 1-2, the first pass is by me, the second pass is by the guy, or in German, it's a double pass. So like, I give it to him and he gives it back. But in this case, you're thinking about what's the defender going to do about this? And the fact that this is an action that forces the defender into a dilemma is encoded in the word that you use in a way that if you were just a native speaker of Hungarian, you would never notice because you didn't realize that people thought about it in a different way in different languages, in the same way that we call it 1-2 and maybe don't think about this is something you do in a field to pin a defender or to take him out of the game. I mean, we sort of know that that's what it is, but it's not specifically there in the word.
Absolutely. And this is, I think it's a great example from Istvan. I loved that. And it's something I wrote about in the article, What is Relationism? And I'm mentioning this difference of words, the differences of language and the importance of language. And it's interesting, the 1-2, as we call it in Western Europe, it's numerical, right? There's a bit coldness to that, right? It's just
you hate numbers, so you've got a problem with numbers.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's clear. But anyway, that's a side issue.
I'll try and leave it aside, Ken, but it just creeps in. It's why they're not for me. Right, but yeah, okay, so what it speaks to, though, as well, is this larger idea of, and again, go back to some of the work of Marcus Sullivan, the idea that the player's form of life, right, the environment in which they've grown up in and been influenced by, is really important in terms of football and how players are perceiving this game on the real-time perceptual level. And like you say, the language is a hugely important part of that, those environmental influences. And that's, I think, just a fantastic example of how some kind of external aspect like language, and you're saying that uses this idea of forcing the hand of the opponent, completely changes the dynamic of what that move means. And for me, this is real. For me, this is football tactics, right? This is tactics. Now we're getting into it, right? It's from the bottom up. These things are emergent. Yes, we have a top down. Of course, we have a top down in positions. They're always going to be there, but we need, for me, far more fruitful and interesting, and I think fun and playful way of engaging with football tactics is to do exactly these kinds of things and think about how the environmental influences, how the perceptions of the players are coming together. You're going to get differences, right? You get a Hungarian player with a Brazilian player with these different interpretations of what the same move means. And then you get, like when different cultures end up in the same place, you get cross-pollinations of language and new words, things, and new things emerge. Then you get novelty, right? Because you're getting these different interpretations all mixing together with each other. And that, for me, is really fascinating. And that's a really, I think, beautiful way of thinking about what football tactics is and can be, rather than, oh, they're playing 3-2-5 and that guy's a chess master, and then he tweaked that and it's like, yeah, okay, like, that's fine. But when you get to the level that Istvan's talking about there, and it's interesting that, again, a current example from a team that's going to be competing at the Euros this year, using, and I think, Benny, you mentioned Szoboszlai, and I think this type of football would seem to benefit a guy like Szoboszlai, who's such an incredible footballer, that, yeah, get the ball to Dominic, and let's organize around him. This is what Argentina did with Messi in the World Cup. They're explicit about that. They were like, yeah, we could play all these tactical setups, but we've got Messi, right? So get the ball to him, get close around him, make walls for him to bounce off, and let's go. And it's like, it's not naive to do that. That's not tactically naive.
Well, if you got Messi, I mean, it's, you know, not everybody does.
Sure, sure. But, you know, it's all relative, isn't it? Like, whatever level you have, you're going to have players that are, like, able to interact in certain kinds of ways. And if you can also try to develop more players of these kinds of capabilities, that would be a good thing. But I think it's nice that you bring up that example, because it's one of my favorite things about this whole research, is to think about tactics in these ways, and I don't think it's done really at all actually, in coaching discourse and tactical discourse that I'm aware of anyway.
Let me ask you about Roy Keane.
Okay.
He's obviously bored by Pep-style tactics. He's always demanding players play more 1-2s. He's always talking about the emotional side of the game. You know, maybe I'll just smash someone. It might make me feel, get the crowd going and maybe I'll feel better. You know, he even regrets in his career having adopted like an Arsene Wenger for a while, you know, steamed fish and vegetables diet, which left him apparently underweight. And
he wanted raw meat or something like that.
Well, he was like, we like our chips, you know. So is Roy Keane, we've been calling him a dinosaur. Is he, in fact, a relationist? Have people been condescending to this man, saying, "Oh, he's been, you know, he's been left behind by the advance of football." Actually, he's been, you know, he's been onto something all along, and he deserves more respect.
Well, I mean, Keane, he tried his hand at management, didn't he, Roy Keane? And I don't think it went particularly well. And
no, it didn't go great. But you know, the players, you know, with this crooked timber, what could, you know, he couldn't do anything.
I get the point. And I mean, I probably don't know enough about Roy Keane to speak, about this per se. But I think that we've already mentioned that. Okay, if you're gonna, like, let's say, reject this Guardiolan idea, the zonal play, the positional play, the boring pass, whatever. But you have to, for me, relationism isn't just rejecting that and saying, yeah, we want to just, you know, do whatever. And okay, he mentions 1-2s, but okay, like, that's a fairly rudimentary thing to mention. Like, relationism for me is about how you're making a collective organization using different organizational reference points, right? So I don't know if Roy Keane's thinking in those terms. Maybe he is. I don't know if he's going that next step.
He's talking about 1-2s like Cole and Yorkie in the Nou Camp.
That's also an Escudinha, actually, isn't it?
This is one of the examples I've seen you use of a classic relationist move. Was Ferguson's Man United? Was this an example of this type of football?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely moments of it, right? And it's like, I guess what I'm trying to do is say, okay, well, let's look at the ways that these players. And the thing is, Ken, I don't know if these were like conscious, these just did they just happen, these moves? Probably. So it's interesting then to say, well, can we actually look at these kinds of structures that evolved, that emerged in these teams that maybe just had more freedom in general, and just the players were, you know, very good players and they just did these things once in a while. Is there ways of actually saying, okay, we can use these to actually build a sophisticated tactical system that can go up, because we're in 2024 now, right? And like, positional systems are incredibly effective. So it's not about this whole relationism idea. Isn't about, like, I think John McKenzie again mentioned it, it's about going back to what Brazil was in the 1980s. It's not about going, for me, it's nothing to do with that, right? Of course, you're going to look at things from the past, but it's about building a sophisticated, modern tactical system that can be effective in modern day football. So yeah, maybe it's about looking for some of those motifs that emerged in teams like Ferguson's Manchester United and going, okay, how do we use these then as reference points to actually organize in a non-zonal way? And yeah, you can take little reference points from different teams, and that's something that I like to do, is to go through various teams that I like, Colombia 1990, Argentina 2006, you know, various teams, and go, wow, what are they doing? How are they organizing? And can we actually put these together and think of ways that we can actually organize in a contemporary, modern, sophisticated way? So that it is actually effective. And yeah, like I say, the early signs are of teams like Hungary and Malmo in Sweden, of course, would be probably the most prominent example I would use of a team that's having good results using these types of ideas.
Yeah. Although, you know, it does feel like maybe a bit of a losing battle in a way. Like, you know, I mean, I'm thinking back to, I think also during the World Cup, was it Adam Hurry at The Athletic did a great little piece about how the World Cup always looks the same now. And what was, I think he had sort of looked at, like, literally how the World Cup looked on TV going all the way back to, I don't know, it's 1970, maybe that was the first color one. I can't remember exactly how far back he went. But I think 2002, he had sort of picked as the last one that looked kind of different compared to all the other ones that you could look at and say, well, that's, and since then it's just look the same. It's like this, it's a standard thing. It doesn't matter where. And, you know, if we go back to where we started, because I know I've kept you here for a long time, but if we go back to where we started with that one, Leo also writing during that World Cup, and he was talking about this homogenization in, you know, in the sphere of coaching and tactics. He finishes that piece by saying, are you wondering how we get football back to how it was? Forget it. The type of football, the type of person who plays football is different now, but that happens in every field, music, art, whatever. We are formed by the culture around us. The new generations will get used to VAR as a natural thing. Don't get me started on that, or statistics either. So basically, like, look, this is happening, you know? You may not like it, but you can't turn it back. And this is just what things are going to look like.
Yeah, but again, I don't think it's about turning back, right? This is the thing. And yeah, well, the problem, right, if football looks the same, the homogenization, but then I would go from my own experience, what, where are we now? Like a year and a half ago, again, like a couple of years ago, I'm a positional coach, I'm into all this stuff. But then I see Fernando Diniz's Fluminense, and this is 2022, right? This is not long ago. And that football is different. And I saw it, I was like, holy shit, right? What the hell is going on here? Because these guys are controlling the ball, they're playing possession, they're winning games. They won the Copa Libertadores for the first time in the club's 124-year history, right? So it's a huge, huge deal for Fluminense to do that. And they did it by playing a radically alternative style of football, of course, which is one of the reasons why this whole debate has emerged in the way that it has. So it's fine to say, oh yeah, nothing ever changed. But for me, these are concrete on-field examples of the, you know, the contrary. That is different. And I suppose it's how you react to that. Do you say, oh, that's just some anomaly and that's just a, you know, or whatever? Or do you say, actually, hang on, there's something in here that we could maybe use to try and develop something new? And this is the whole, and I think Barney Rooney put it really well in the piece he wrote about Rydström and Malmo and this whole issue he wrote in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago. It was a fun piece, you comparing Rydström to Jason Statham, which I didn't expect, but, you know, that's quite fun. And he, the thing I liked most about what he said was that this whole debate actually gives us the chance to talk about the possibility of an alternative, right? To actually say, hang on a minute, maybe we can move away from positional play. But it's also, I mean, it's important to say as well, positional play is not one thing. It is developing on its own trajectory, of course, and it always will and always has. But is there another lineage, another trajectory, another version of reality, right, that can be actually moved into and tapped into to find out, to find a genuine alternative? And I think that, you know, it's easy to say, oh yeah, things never changed. This is the way it is now. This is the path we're going down. But for me, this is, you know, not particularly interesting. And I think it's way more generative and hopefully generative of interesting novelty and newness to actually take these emergences like Diniz's Fluminense, take them seriously and say, what is going on here? What are the things we can use from this? And can we, like Malmo are doing, put a little bit of that into our Swedish mix? Not to copy, not to say that we want to be Fernando Diniz in Malmo, because that would be stupid, but to say, oh wow, maybe there's something in here that we can put a seed and then look at that mixture and how that hybridity mutates and emerges and comes up into and grows to something different. So I mean, it's about perspective, isn't it? I mean, you can say that about anything. You know, nothing changes. It's all, you know, that's the way it is now. Maybe I'm too optimistic, Ken. I don't know. I prefer to take this possibility of alternatives seriously and try and investigate and explore them, you know?
Okay. Well, listen, it's been great talking to you, Jamie, and best of luck with this this rogue movement. That you're trying to, you know, spread around the world. Good luck spreading the gospel.
All right, Ken, thanks for having me. Real pleasure.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sure.
If you said black, he'd say white. If you said white, he'd say black.
Well, there was a suggestion that there was sort of an all-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
You can't argue with people like that.
When you were before, Jack, if I can start by asking you, when you took over the Republic of Ireland job, you did you set out any particular aims for yourself and for the team? Just
like an angel. It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein. You could have one drink, no more, and then you're back to the hotel and you're off to bed.
There's been suggestions recently that there was no major problem with players, with what players did a couple of days before a game. I wish I was
special. But we always, on the way back, the lads would start to sing, "We love you, Jackie, we do." Which meant, can we stop for a pint? But I'm a creep.
Jack, I want to ask you about Brian Kerr. Were the hotels besieged by fans and all that sort of thing when they went out on the town? Now, I want to get your thoughts on this because times certainly seem to have changed over the last 10 or 15 years as regards player preparation and the rest of that.
Not at all. I don't like people like him.
Back in your time, there was that famous Harry Ramsden's challenge, which has been talked about many times, and there was a suggestion that there was sort of an all-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
All-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
And we came back into Dublin, and when we were coming in, I said to the lads, do you want some fish and chips?
With all the Celtic Tiger and everything that's happened in Ireland, that we've actually changed as a people.
It was more of it than anything else. I was at Harry Ramsden's the other night, and it was brilliant.
And we're more selfish, maybe, and a bit more mean and a bit more greedy.
So we stopped for fish and chips. What's wrong? Whatever you want. Stopping for fish and chips the day before a game. You're so fucking special. You get a plate full of fish and chips and you eat the fish and chips if you want them. Nobody had any soup to start with, nobody had any puddings to finish with. They had fish and chips. And I like fish and chips. And the players like the fish and chips. I think it was because the following day we lost the game. No, you can't blame fish and chips for losing a game.
No.
Can you?
For News Talk 106 Sport, I'm Owen McDevitt.
I've got it, Ken.
What do you got, Owen?
After listening to Jamie there, the next great tactical leap in modern football. Head tennis, lads. He's talking about using the air.
Aerial combinations,
right? It's something flicking it over here, but that's fine. But what about just getting, you want three forwards in your team. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, your man at Luton, Carlton Morris.
Yeah.
I'm trying, somebody else who's great in the air.
I'm surprised a Luton player came so readily to find their role. I wonder why that was.
You want three forwards in your team, one of whom is Dominic Calvert-Lewin.
Yeah, I want them all to be really good in the air.
I was looking on at some. I was just poring over the usual expected goals stats.
Doesn't matter about expected goals. It's headers. Jules won. He's the top of the Premier League for Jules.
Oh, I got a specific request for you to talk about Liverpool's XG on Saturday. How do I find that out, Ken? Or yesterday?
What was Liverpool's XG
yesterday? For,
2.87 or something like this. Jesus. But they. I was just looking to see who's been doing well. Who's not been? You know, Man City slightly overperforming their XG. Obviously, they've got a couple of decent finishers there. Arsenal overperforming, Liverpool underperforming. It
doesn't matter in this new way of playing football.
But I was like, who's the biggest underperformers? I was like, Liverpool 6.77. This is the understat XG. Liverpool 6.77. They've got 6.77 more than they've actually scored, so that's not great. Looking down, Bournemouth, 6.28. Okay, there's Chelsea, 7.35. Obviously, Nicholas Jackson's had his issues. Everton, 20. 20. Everton should have scored 20 goals more than they've scored.
Jesus.
According to this. They've scored, they should have scored 52. They've scored 32.
Doesn't matter. In this new dream team,
you want Dominic Calvert-Lewin.
You need players to win headers. He wins a lot of headers. You have three strikers. They all win headers. They all those, they just basically keep the ball in the air for as long as they need to, as long as they want, just heading to each other. That drags the defenders out of position. They don't know what to do. You can't throw a tackle in. Just standing there going, what?
Arteta,
I need to get
just
back to my position. Arteta there. Will be stumped.
Just, oh, they, can they do that? Like running up to the ref, like shouting, yeah, waving his do something. You've got to do something.
And then eventually, when the defender, one defender switches off, and that's when you get your little midfielders in. You need runners just in midfield.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just need somebody running, timing correctly, get the ball that is then just allowed to drop off Ollie Watkins's head.
Watkins, yeah.
And then midfielder scores.
Basically, Owen's idea of football is that video from the Real Madrid dressing room a couple of years ago of Marcelo's son.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Heading him back to all the players. Yeah.
That's basically dream football. That is the next 10 years of football in
the
world.
I mean, I know when Jamie was talking about aerial combinations, obviously I've got a few of them in mind, you know, but when I go into my mind palace, you know, a lot of the wallpapers of those types of, you know, combinations, Quinn, Finn and Quinn, Keane, you know, that kind of stuff. But at the same time, the problem is, I was reminded also of what Jonathan Wilson was saying, that, you know, that the teams, like a jazz quartet can play jazz, but like it's not jazzing, you know, football, you're not jazzing against yourself. There's another team involved. Yeah. that
kind of disrupt your jazz session.
Yeah, that is the problem. When we're talking
a
about
a marching band compared to the jazz, jazz scene, the jazz club.
Aerial combinations are all very well, but if there is another team trying to get the ball off you and then sort of passing it away really quickly and, you know, running into the space you've vacated, is that going to cause problems?
Well,
has it been tried?
Ken.
Does your team full of 6'7" lumberers, how are they actually equipped to stop these little fellas running around between their legs?
If Wilson wants to fire back at Jamie, you can always send us a voice note. Minimum 8 minutes.
All right.
The Champions League this week.
Kill your jets.
Including Wednesday night, Bayern Munich against Arsenal. Manchester City against Real Madrid. We'll be talking about all that on the World Service. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you all. Thank you, Ken.
Oh, and thank you, Ken.
Thanks for listening. Fun week ahead. Sign up on secondcaptains.com. You'll hear all episodes without any ads, and you will be supporting member-led journalism. Second Cabin's podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.